This is day two of this January 2014 Rohatsu 7-day session. By the way, Rohatsu literally means the eighth day of the 12th month, but it originated in reference to a lunar month. So the lunar month sometimes extends into the new year. Doesn't necessarily always in our December. And we'll return to our text from yesterday, the Way of Korean Zen by 20th century Zen master Kusan Sunim. Yesterday we covered his biography, his brief biography, and today we'll jump into what he calls, instructions for meditation. Now this is, here he's focusing on koan meditation, but many people here are, most people here are working on first koan, and to them especially this will be very suitable. And the subtitle of this instructions for meditation is Wadu Meditation. Wadu is the Chinese Korean word for not just the koan, but the nub of the koan. So with a koan like mu, you could say that the koan as a whole is the story about the monk who asked Joshu, does even a dog have Buddha nature, and so forth. The wado is the nub, just the word mu, or what is mu. So this word that's quite unfamiliar to most people, wadu, I'll use just the word koan, but it means the nub of the koan, not the whole story. And he begins just generally to say, a human being is composed of a body and a mind. A body without a mind is just a dead corpse. A mind without a body is just pure spirit. Human beings are said to be superior to all other creatures. But how can a human being be considered superior if he knows his body but is ignorant of the nature of his mind? One who knows the body but not the mind is an incomplete person. However, if a human being searches for the mind and awakens to it, he will realize completeness, for at that time he will know both body and mind. Here he's using the word mind to mean our essential mind, our true mind, our Buddha mind. When you realize this true nature, then you understand the body-mind complex. That is, mind with a small m, the body-mind complex in a different way. But he's primarily referring here to realizing this our Buddha nature. He says, but upon awakening, this world becomes a pure land, but as long as you are only concerned with the body, and you are enslaved by the environment, this world will remain as a defiled realm. As long as you're only concerned with the body, what's implied is the body and its pains and pleasures, and enslaved by the environment. This, I think, is a broader issue for human beings than just attachment to the body. Well, maybe not, but anyway, I think the difficulty that is more obvious to most people is the way that we are caught in reacting to conditions and circumstances, enslaved by the environment, always trying to arrange our environment to maximize pleasure or gratify our desires and avoid aversion, or in other words, likes and dislikes, making our life project focusing on our likes and trying to avoid what we dislike. This sounds awfully primitive, but really it's very much at the basis of the way most people live their lives. The Zen master Sun Tzu addresses this and pounds away at this in his Affirming Faith and Mind that we do, about this continually dividing the world into what we want and what we don't want, what we like and what we don't like. This, I think, goes on at a subliminal level, a level of unawareness, much more than most of us realize. Most of us are doing this constantly, trying to get what we like, what we prefer, and avoid what we don't like. As long as we are operating in that mode, we will be enslaved by conditions and circumstances. Zen practice enables us to acquire some freedom from that, so we're not continually reacting to things. And we get a good practice at this in sesshin. The conditions of cold and lack of sleep, the physical pain that we have to work with, learn to work with, and many other things. He continues, "The purpose of practicing Zen meditation is to awaken to the mind." There it is. Boom. Let me just say that the Zen practice will bring many other benefits besides awakening, but the real promise of it is awakening to this true nature, realizing who and what we really are. Such practice, he goes on, does not involve just sitting quietly and trying to calm and pacify the mind. It involves direct inquiry into a koan. An example of a koan would be a question such as, "What is this?" or "What is this mind?" And of course also, "What is mu? Who am I? What am I?" Essential, basic, essential questions that can only truly be resolved through awakening. What you are searching for can be called by many different names: mind, spirit, soul, true nature, and so forth. But such designations are merely labels. You should put aside all of these names and reflect on the fact that the true master of the body is more than just the label mind. The master of the body is not Buddha, for it is not yet awakened. Nor is it anything material, because it cannot be physically given away or received. Nor is it simply empty space, for empty space cannot pose questions or have knowledge of good and evil. Hence, there is a master who rules this body who is neither the label mind, the Buddha, a material thing, or empty space. Having negated these four possibilities, a question will arise as to what this master really is. Let me just pause and point out that this term master is it seemed to be much more fundamental in Asian culture, which is China, Korea, Japan. These are much more hierarchical cultures than our own, and the hierarchy is based on the Confucian model of senior and junior, and master and servant, master and disciple, and here it may not work as well for most of us, this term master, but so we can render it in our own ways, the ultimate principle, let's say. There are plenty of synonyms for this. But he's using master, so I'll read it as he put it, but understand that master really means this, the ineffable, the illimitable, that which cannot be encompassed in words. Or you could say that force or ultimate reality that cannot be known with our ordinary mind or with the senses. It's beyond these six senses of there are five ordinary senses and our discriminating mind. In theistic religions, it's God. But okay, whatever you call it, the point in Zen is to know it experientially, not just settle into a noun for it. If you continue inquiring in this way, the questioning will become more intense. Finally, when the mass of questioning enlarges to a critical point, it will suddenly burst. The entire universe will be shattered, and only your original nature will appear before you. In this way, you will awaken. When he says the entire universe will be shattered, it's just a figure of speech. Of course, it means that the universe as something other will no longer be. Just as the self, as an object, a mere object, the ego, will no longer be. We see through both self and other. Self and the so-called universe. With regard to this word master, Basui, we know from the Three Pillars of Zen and the Dharma talks of Japanese Zen master Basui, this was his question. Who is the master? What is God? What is ultimate reality? Or what is the original self? It's another version of it. He continues, it is most important to continuously investigate the koan with unswerving determination. At the beginning, you might feel as though you are trying to lift a heavy bucket full of water with a weak arm. This, I think many people would relate to, is the first couple, 3 days of Sesshin. Even so, you should never relax your effort. Instead, no matter what you are doing, be solely concerned with nothing but the koan. If a clock were unreliable and kept stopping, any sensible person would either have it repaired or get rid of it. Similarly, when practicing meditation, you must exert continuous effort and not allow yourself to be lazy. Continuous effort. Notice he's not saying, and he never would, continuous success. This is, some people get hung up on this. They get so critical of their effort and that it doesn't match what they think they should be doing. That's a defilement of the mind to be finding fault with your effort. The important thing is to keep the effort continuous. It's not a matter of measuring your practice and finding yourself always falling short of your goal, but just making this continuous effort. And that can be very difficult when you're going through a period where nothing much seems to be happening. But that's where the faith comes in. To continue returning your attention to the practice, even when it doesn't seem to be doing much. Because there is change happening that we don't see. And that becomes more obvious later in a sesshin. We see later in sesshin that all that that effort is not just spinning our wheels, but it was somehow purifying the mind, somehow emptying the mind in its own way, in its own pace. In working on a koan, the key factor is to maintain a constant sense of questioning. So, having taken hold of the koan, what is this? Try to always sustain the questioning. What is seeing? What is hearing? What is moving these hands and feet? And so on. Before the initial sense of questioning fades, it is important to give rise to the question again. In this way, the process of questioning can continue uninterrupted with each new question overlapping the previous one. So this, let me read that again. It's an instruction that I never got working on Mu, but it sounds like a good thing to try. Before the initial sense of questioning fades, it's important to give rise to the question again. In this way, the questioning can continue uninterrupted with each new question overlapping the previous one. I once read this referred to as the bamboo method of working on a koan. The reference to the bamboo comes from the way that a stalk of bamboo has these knuckles that overlap, these overlapping seams. So, in the case of Mu, rather than just, say, exhaling Mu and then allowing a gap, to keep it in the mind continuously, seamlessly. And then he says, in addition, you should try to make this overlapping smooth and regular. But this does not mean that you should just mechanically repeat the question as though it were a mantra. It is useless to just say to yourself day and night, what is this? What is this? What is this? What is this? What is moo? What's moo? What's moo? The key is to sustain the sense of questioning. To sustain the sense of questioning, not the repetition of the words. Once this inquiry gets underway, there will be no room for boredom. If the mind remains quiet, the koan will not be forgotten, and the sense of questioning will continue unbroken. In this way, awakening will be easy. There'll be no room for boredom. Boredom is a terrific signal that you're on the surface of your practice. It's not unusual to have periods of boredom, especially in early years of practice, but it's a great kind of a biofeedback or cognofeedback that you need to get more absorbed in your practice. So one form of boredom is getting impatient for the round to end. Oh, will this round never end? Are they never going to hit that bell? For God's sake, let's deliver me from this practice. That's a kind of boredom, just waiting for things to change. But we find, especially in Sesshin, that's our best shot. We find that we can prevail over boredom. We have the power of the mind by concentrating, by reaching deeper states of absorption. There is no room for boredom. So if you find yourself bored, just renew your effort and you'll find you're able to get beyond it. And once you can get beyond, through the power of the mind, once you can get beyond boredom, facing a wall, then you'll find it much easier to be spared boredom in ordinary circumstances. Of course, everything that we're learning in Zendo are things that we can apply in our daily lives. If you're talking to someone and you find yourself bored, well, listen better. Get into the get it more engaged with the person. You don't have to settle for this dreary state of mind we call boredom. Now, there may be people who would be more boring than a blank wall, but then, okay, then you just have to try harder. He goes on, while meditating, both wisdom and concentration need to be cultivated in unison. Now, before going further, let me just say that in Buddhist meditation of every kind, really, one of the general points about it is that there are two sides to it, or two features or aspects of Buddhist meditation, not just Zen, but other kinds of Buddhist meditation. And the two are the realm of awareness and the realm of quiescence, the aspect of quiescence and the aspect of awareness. And so the translator here is using the words wisdom and concentration for this, for awareness and calmness or quiescence. And then I'll just continue using his words. If there is wisdom without concentration, then mistaken views will increase. And if there is concentration without wisdom, then ignorance will grow. So, let's put it this way. We can get into states of calm where there is no brightness to it. There is no, there's not much awareness. It's just a kind of a tranquilized state. And this is quite possible doing Zen meditation. It can become a state of, yes, tranquility, but tranquilized at the same time. This is something that surely we all know, especially from the early stage of a sesshin, this dullness. And then it also can be states of bright awareness, but the mind is not really at rest the way it is in the other states of tranquility. So a mature practice of meditation will integrate these two. So there is deep calm, but at the same time, bright awareness. But that can take a long time to find a balance between those two. And until then, it's our job to be vigilant, which is a kind of awareness, that's the awareness side, to be vigilant and notice when we're going to one extreme or the other. That's the problem with these states of tranquility, is the noticing is not very strong. And we can spend a whole round in a quiet, calm, tranquil state and realize that by the end that we haven't been really very present. Let's let him say this in his own way. When inquiring single-mindedly into the koan, what is this? The vividness of the koan becomes wisdom, and the cessation of distracted thoughts becomes concentration. Meditation can be compared to a battle between wandering thoughts and dullness of mind on the one side and the koan on the other. And this is good. So the twin dangers is wandering thoughts, we all know about those, but also dullness of mind. And with real keen absorption in the koan, then we will be free of both of those problems. He says the stronger the koan becomes, of course he means the absorption in the koan, the weaker will become wandering thoughts and dullness. And this is the same with breath practice or shikantaza. This is now what he's talking about is not just koan practice. The stronger the awareness of the breath becomes, the weaker will become wandering thoughts and dullness. The classic simile, the analogy for this, these two things is the pond, where you have a pond that's all roiled up. That's the distracted thoughts. It's all roiled up by the winds of thought, and so initially we focus on this quiescent aspect, the concentration or quieting of the mind through single-minded concentration on anything, koan or breath practice. And this settles the water. When the thoughts settle down, then the pond becomes calm, and then we can see into the depths of it. That's the awareness side of it. So the calming, first the calming of the pond waters, and then from that comes the seeing. You are not the first, and you will not be the last. to tread this path. So do not become discouraged if you find the practice difficult at times. All the previous patriarchs of old, as well as the contemporary masters, have experienced hardships along this way. Well, this almost goes without saying. Surely anyone who's got this far to be in a sesshin knows that there's just one hurdle after another, one obstacle to work through after another, that periods of good concentration alternate with periods of poorer concentration, and that's just the way it is. Deal with it. It's just the way it is. We're not machines. You can't throw a switch and just be running at optimum concentration all the time. And that's not just the hardships of sagging concentration. It's also just the other things, the pain, not to mention the discouragement, self-doubt. But if one perseveres in the face of these things and really perseveres, then sooner or later one will find one's way through these things. That's why we are so strong about making a commitment when you come to sesshin, committing to staying the full length of what you've committed to, following through with that commitment. Most people, it's for this sesshin, it's 7 days. There are a couple others who aren't staying for the full 7 days. But whatever you've committed to, see it through. And the reason for that is so that the person can find for herself or himself that these hardships, these obstructions are just passing states. They're temporary. They will pass. We will pass them if the perseverance is dogged enough. If you fall into despair and say, I can't do this, and you leave the sesshin, then you lose the opportunity to see that you can prevail over these things. In a recent sesshin, someone was ready to pack it in after 4 days, maybe, or 3 days maybe, and as always when that happens, it's not very often that happens, but when it does, I desperately try to discourage the person from leaving, short of tying them up. Sometimes I'm practically begging on my hands and knees that they will not leave. And this last time it happened, the guy was a whisker away from finding his way out of here. And then he realized he had to deal with getting to the airport and how he's going to do that and the taxi fare and all the other things, rebooking the flight and paying the penalty. And that kept him in sesshin. I mean, sesshin's hard, but airline travel these days is... And then he continues, moreover, it is not always the most virtuous or intelligent person who makes the swiftest progress. Sometimes the opposite is true. There are many cases of troublesome and ill-behaved people who, upon turning their attention inward to the practice of meditation, have quickly experienced a breakthrough. So do not feel defeated even before you have really begun. This is true, and this is why I try to work with people who are not accommodating themselves to the rules and the guidelines of, in this case, let's say, Sesshin or staff training. I try to work with them and not just boot them out as soon as they become a nuisance or a disturbance to other people. Sometimes those people can turn it around, and sometimes they can't. Intelligent, of course, it's not. Intelligence is not going to particularly help you, especially working on a first koan or breath practice. It's more likely to hinder you because, well, let's not talk about intelligence, but intellectually minded people tend to play with concepts. They like to make fine connections in their thoughts and their ideas. And this, of course, is going to be trouble in Zen practice because you don't want to have anything to do with those thoughts. He continues, an ancient master once said that with the passing of the days, you will see your thoughts becoming identical with the koan and the koan becoming identical with your thoughts. This is quite true. Now, I had to reread this to understand what he means here, because it wasn't immediately obvious to me. I think, from drawing from my own experience, I think what he's saying is that when you've... when you're getting beyond the ordinary distractions and all, that there can be a way in which the koan and the passing thoughts get kind of mixed up. But it's our job then to distinguish between them and keep the attention on the koan or on the breath. It doesn't matter here. It works the same with the breath. To have that single-mindedness of focus that we're not getting drawn into the thoughts. That means distinguishing them from the breath or the koan. But there can be, as the mind settles, there can be a way in which the two kind of get blended up. In the final analysis, the practice of Zen can be said to be both the easiest as well as the most difficult thing to do. Okay, how is it the easiest thing? The easiest is that every step of the way, we have a choice of whether to linger in our thoughts or to turn our attention back to the practice. Right there. And it doesn't need to be some titanic battle. It's a matter of just turning our attention back to the practice, the breath or the koan or whatever it is. That doesn't have to be difficult. It becomes difficult if we find the thoughts enticing and we think that there's something for us in those thoughts. Then we're going to balk at turning the attention back to the practice. We're going to want to just finish up that thought, follow it, follow through with the thought, and which is then likely to carry us further afield. But it is easy. Certainly, it's simple, It's uncomplicated. It's just a matter of returning our attention over and over and over again to the practice, detaching from the thoughts, letting them go. There it is. How complicated is that? The difficulty, of course, comes because of the force of habit, mental habit, of wanting to cling to the thoughts, to pursue the thoughts. And he said, after saying it's both the easiest as well as the most difficult thing to do, then he says, however, do not thereby deceive yourself into thinking that it will be either very simple or extremely hard. His point is, don't make a notion out of it being simple or difficult. That just adds to the problem of framing it in your mind as easy or difficult. It's just another thought. There is no one who can undertake this task for you. The student's hunger can never be satisfied by his teacher's eating a meal for him. It is like competing in a marathon. The winner will only be the person who is either the fittest or the most determined. It is solely up to the individual to win the race. Likewise, to achieve the aim of your practice, do not be distracted by things that are not related to this task. For the time being, just let everything else remain as it is and put it out of your mind. There it is. Again, a simple formula, uncomplicated. Just let everything else remain as it is and put it out of your mind. And then he says, only when you are awakened will you be able to truly benefit others. Meaning, it is only by seeing the unity of all existences, seeing beyond the duality of self and other, us and them, that we acquire the full capacity to be of service to others. Or to put it another way, it's only when we can see through the ego that our work will not be contaminated by the ego. Even our good works, our good deeds, our service, social service, political service, whatever we're doing to help others, to change the world for the better, is to the degree that we've seen through the self, it will be not less contaminated. Our efforts will be less contaminated by that egoistic defilement. Our time is up. We'll stop now and recite four vows.